Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. Episode 16, Making Student-Teacher Observations Purposeful.
Hello and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. It's just the two of us today in the radio studio. For those of you who like to watch us on YouTube, there aren't many of you, but unfortunately this is not a video recorded episode.
No, it's too small. Can't get any cameras in here.
Yeah, it is.
Isn't it? Although we love it. We like this studio. We should come in here more often.
We should. Although we're sort of still getting to know its quirks, aren't we? Some funny noises going on in here, but hopefully they won't be too distracting. As you heard in the opening title, we're here to talk about student teachers' observations. We're taking a sort of two-pronged approach to this episode. We're going to be thinking about student teachers who are observing expert or experienced teachers in the classroom and how to prepare them for that, how to help them make the most of that, but also for mentors, teacher educators working with student teachers, how to set up observation of student teachers teaching in such a way that they're going to sort of get the most out of it and that you will be able to do it justice as a strategy.
Yeah, and we're hoping that although, as we never cease to go on about, we are in a specific place here. We're in Wales. We've got a slightly specific education system, particularly if you are based in England. This one should be pretty relevant to everybody, because I would say anybody pretty much learning to be a teacher is going to have a bit where they have to observe their experienced colleagues in school, even if they only do a single placement, do some teaching. It often happens at the start of a teacher education or teacher training experience, and they will also get observed by some sort of mentor figure as well. So it's quite relevant to everybody, and it's also, I think, possibly not controversial to say that it's quite easy, if you're not careful, to think, oh, the observation bit, where the student teacher does some observations, and just sort of park them at the back and let it all wash over them and kind of leave it at that. And that was what we're trying to avoid in this.
We are. And we could start to get into the challenges of that and why, you know, that particular approach might not be fruitful. However, we had some school colleagues get in a room with us prior to laying down some content that's going into our own in-house mentoring handbook to discuss, you know, thrash out and look at the sort of research around teacher observation as a tool, particularly the challenges that student teachers face, but are certainly not exclusive to student teachers, before we could put together some strategies that mentors may wish to employ in their own context with their student teachers in order to ensure that we can really make the most of observation. So we're about to hear a clip, aren't we, Tom?
We are, yes. So we've got a number of school colleagues who helped us with this, and we'll do our very best to name check them all. The first voice that you're going to hear is Lauren Rees, who's the senior mentor at Stanwell School, just down the road in Penarth. And then the other voice will be Scott Morgan, who's the senior mentor at St Nicholas Primary School, also just down the road from us. And we started off by asking them the question, really, why student teachers observing experienced colleagues is something that's worth chewing over in this way. So let's have a listen to Lauren and Scott talking to Emma.
Lesson observations must be an active learning experience for the student teachers. Not only does it give them insight into how the teachers teach, but how the learners learn as well, which I think sometimes can be lost when they do observations and they focus on the teacher and they're not looking at the learners themselves. Another really important purpose is understanding the school that they are in, the vision, the context. You know, CP1 and CP2 are often very different schools. So it's often like starting over again. You know, you have to know their teaching approaches, their policies, the context. It's so vital for those observations.
And There are a number of different ways that you can do observation, but how should they be conducted so that student teachers are learning the most from them?
Well, first and foremost, I think student teachers need to be prepared for the observations. They need to know exactly what they're looking for before they embark on any kind of observation. During the observations, mentors need to encourage the student teachers to critically analyse and evaluate what they're finding. And this is then going to inform their judgments. Through this process, this may help challenge preconceptions or assumptions the student teachers may already have about what good teaching and learning looks like. And we need to remember that observation is a learning strategy for our student teachers, and this will help them prepare their own practice for the future. Therefore, it needs to be planned strategically to encourage breadth and depth of experience.
Thank you. So when should student teachers be observing?
Always. It is absolutely intrinsic to any teacher's ongoing professional learning. You know, when you're starting out as a student teacher, when you come to do your induction year, and then experienced teachers as well. It's something that they should be doing throughout CP1 and CP2, not just at the start of both placements.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I think observation needs to be viewed as a continuum, where student teachers begin with early observations, unpicking maybe isolated features, one or two things that they think is good, and then moving all the way through to when they are practicing teachers, where they are applying more and more their findings into their practice.
And I suppose reflecting on hearing that again, we get a sense of how challenging and complex the act of observation can be, not just for a student teacher, but teachers in general. If you haven't done that prep, if you don't understand and know a few things about the context in which the observation is taking place. So, this really speaks to the skills, the knowledge that are sort of bound up in the observation as a learning medium for the student teacher.
Yeah, and we've gone on at great length, haven't we, in quite a few episodes about all of this stuff about why being a teacher is complicated and why learning to be a teacher is complicated. You know, if you have managed somehow to escape us going on about that, you can listen back to various episodes that we've done recently. But it sort of hits me there as I listen to all of that stuff that it's kind of funny that often when a student teacher starts somewhere new, the first thing they'll be asked to do is to observe. And yet we know that the classroom environment is very, very complicated with an awful lot of stuff going on. And yet we know as well that actually learning to be a teacher, actually understanding what's going on kind of underneath the surface with that stuff is extremely difficult. And yet, strangely, we sometimes seem to think, and I mean, I'm saying this from the position that we have not really up to this point done a brilliant job of nailing down the details of observation. We sort of think that if they park themselves at the back of the classroom, something's going to sort of just go in.
Yes, and this really speaks to something that I've banged on about in the past on this podcast on more than one occasion, about the fact that a teacher educator has their own pedagogical content knowledge. And so they need to, when thinking about using observation as a pedagogical approach or an andragogical approach with a student teacher, they need to be thinking about, you know, what do I know about this student teacher? What do I know about the school? What do I know about this class that they're about to observe me teach? What do I know about my own philosophy for teaching? And what do I really want them to home in on? You know, is that going to be abundantly clear to the student teacher just from watching me do it? Or am I going to need to take some extra steps for them to really understand that? So, you know, like with our own teaching, we wouldn't provide some kind of educational stimulus or resource to our pupils without having first planned how we're going to unpick and unpack that with them. For example, get them to watch a video without giving them some kind of watching brief. So likewise with these teacher education strategies, we need to be tapping into that teacher's brain and thinking, okay, how am I going to do this? Why am I doing it in that way? What do I want the student teacher to gain from this?
And I think one of the keys to this is this other thing that we often talk about, which is that for an experienced teacher, a lot of stuff has become really tacit, really embedded, that they don't really think about it anymore. The learning to drive analogy is our usual standby in this one. And all of us who've been teachers in the classroom will know that there was stuff that you used to have to concentrate like mad on when you were a student teacher, and you just sort of do it without thinking about it. And I know one of the examples of, that we talked about when we were preparing this with our school colleagues was the idea that it's very easy to assume that the student teacher will think, will know what is a good lesson. They might come out of a lesson and go, oh, that was great. And the teacher that was teaching it might be head in hands thinking it was totally disastrous. And at the heart of that might have been a misconception. I mean, particularly for subjects like ours, so-called practical subjects, that the new, totally brand new, untried, untested student teacher might think it was really, really brilliant because the kids were really quiet and compliant all the way through. Whereas the experienced teacher might have their head in the hand saying, that was absolutely disastrous. I got nothing out of them for the whole lesson. And it's even little misconceptions like that that you need to unpack and stick on the table. And not assume that everybody's coming at things from the same place.
Yeah, absolutely. And as with any learner in any situation, unless you do all that good work, the chances are they might switch off. You know, particularly if you've got them in there sat at the back with a clipboard and a piece of paper or the laptop and they're just observing and there's no framework around that for them, then they might lose interest, actually. You know, Hazel Hager talks about this in a book that we're going to talk about later, Hager, Byrne and McIntyre. It's a mentoring handbook. Just that a student teacher, because they're so influenced early on by their own experiences and what their perception and beliefs are about what makes good teaching, they might start watching a lesson and go, oh, this is not how I want to teach, and switch off. And think, no, this is not going to give me anything, so switch off. So there are a number of reasons why there is a sort of before, during and after stages to the process of getting them ready, of getting the most out of and unpicking afterwards, so that that observation has sort of learning currency, basically.
Yeah, because of course the other time somebody might be starting to do observation, they might not be at the start of their programme, they might be on a change of placement, as you sort of imply there. The other time that people do a load of observation is often when they're in a new school and they've got experience of their placement one, and it is a kind of known thing that as a student teacher you get really quite attached to your placement one usually, unless it's gone really, really badly, and you tend to sort of think, right, that's how this is done, this is how my subject is taught, or this is how we do teaching. And then when you go somewhere new, it's completely different. And that's a real culture shock. And again, as an experienced teacher who spent a lot of time in that particular school environment, it can be easy to forget how different it will seem to a student that's just been plucked from a placement one where they were finally starting to feel comfortable and dropped into somewhere which will be more different than they could possibly imagine, no matter how much we warn them about it. So yeah, there's lots of homework to be done before observation periods or even before lesson observations, which help to just make sure that that stuff is as productive as possible. So again, Emma spoke to our two colleagues, Lauren and Scott, and they had a little bit of a discussion of the challenges which face new teachers, student teachers, and to some extent probably serving teachers as well, but we're particularly concentrating on those new teachers, the challenges that face them in terms of things before the observation, and some strategies which will help to mitigate some of those things, which you can carry out either before a lesson observation, or if a student's got a sort of block of observation, before they go into that block of observation. So let's have a listen to Emma, Lauren and Scott discussing that.
Okay, so before the student teacher observes, what challenges do we need to be aware of that they might face at this point?
So firstly, do they understand the purpose of active observation? Secondly, identifying the focus of observation to support their learning. That could include identifying the focus itself. You know, is it AFL they're looking at, differentiation? And then actually understanding what it is they're looking for in that lesson, because you know, we can't assume that they have that knowledge. They often come to us with no experience, and with experienced colleagues, a lot of it is invisible.
Yeah, in the same vein as the second challenge, preparing for observations is another challenge that student teachers may face. We can't assume that they know how to do this without being properly shown how to do it by their mentors. And finally, the last challenge that we believe that student teachers are going to face would be to challenge their own perceptions and their preconceptions about what good teaching and learning looks like.
Of course. And Lauren, is it solely lessons that student teachers can be observing?
No, not at all. You know, obviously, lessons are the first thing that everybody would naturally think about. But also involving them in observing departmental meetings, and especially in primary school, the phase planning meetings. You know, getting those, getting the students involved in those will give them vital insight and understanding before they start their own practice.
Thank you. Okay, so Scott, let's imagine I'm a new mentor and I don't know how to prepare my student teacher for observation. What would you suggest?
The key strategy that I would suggest to a new mentor is to conduct a pre-briefing to establish the purpose, the strategies and the expectations of the observation. The content of these pre-briefings will depend largely on the relationship between the mentor and the student teacher. And also the needs of the student. So first and foremost, the purpose of the observation needs to be established. Are the student teachers aware of what the focus is? Are they looking at a group of learners during the lesson? Are they looking at a pedagogical strategy? Or are they specifically looking at progress during a lesson? It needs to be made very clear to the student teachers that the timing of the session is clear, so they know if they're going to be observing for the full hour, for half an hour, for a part of a lesson, a starter, a plenary. Likewise, in a meeting, are they attending a full departmental meeting or are they just needed for a specific part of it? So the expectations of the role of the student within that role as the observer needs to be made clear. And any relevant information about the learning journey prior to the lesson that's been observed needs to be shared with the student teachers too. I think it's really important for student teachers to really dig deep and look for progress in lessons, and they need to try and identify how to quantify that progress. So how many learners in that class are meeting the learning intention and how many of them are exemplifying the success criteria. And ultimately, they then need to triangulate what they've seen. They need to go back at the end of the session, look at the books to see, can they join up all the dots? Can they connect the preparation, the observation and the evaluation?
Thank you. Okay, so you've done that thorough preparation, that pre-briefing with the student teacher. Lauren, what can the student teacher do next to go that extra few steps before they observe?
Well, one main thing they can do is to go and look at any materials that they have based on the focus that they are going to be observing. So, for example, they have loads of content from university, from SLT days, from any R&E that they have conducted themselves. I know a lot of mentors provide read, watch, listens and other readings for them. So in the same vein that Scott explained about triangulating what they've seen in the lesson is to then also start making those links to the theory. And so they're bridging that gap between practice and theory.
Thank you both.
So a lot going on there in that discussion. And certainly that's quite some distance away from just parking a student teacher at the back and hoping something washes over them.
Yeah, I agree. And what I was reflecting on as I was re-listening to that clip was that if you sort of lay those good foundations, those good working practices, you know, the need to prepare, the need to know what you're looking for, how you're going to look for it, what you're going to use to sort of determine, you know, the efficacy of what you're looking at or whatever, that should become sort of second nature to a teacher later on down the line. And it might be that actually your role as the mentor may become less prescriptive than it was in those early days with a student teacher. You know, later on down the line, when they've become really used to that process, they might be coming to you saying, right, I think the focus needs to be this. And I think the way I need to observe this lesson to really get under the skin of that focus is to do X, Y, or Z. And you know, that's a real sign. You know, I'm thinking about this, some of the language that we use on our particular programs of student teachers becoming more independent, more capable, is that actually the sign that they are ready to sort of fly solo, spread their wings, and the sign that will make you sort of reassured really that they will be able to carry on this good observational practice without you is that they will hopefully be coming to you going, this is how I want to do it, this is what I want to look for, this has worked really well for me in the past, can we do it like this? And I suppose it's this model sort of gives you the scope to do that.
Yeah, and this is where it really started to come out for me when we were discussing this with school colleagues before we recorded those things. And you've hinted at this already earlier on, which is that a lot of this stuff is second nature to teachers when they're working with their pupils, you know, because most, if not all, people who work with student teachers will be really decent classroom teachers themselves. And they will be very aware, I mean, whether they're aware sort of explicitly from having read about it or whether just from their own experience, they'll be very, very aware that if they want their pupils to flourish as independent learners, they're not just going to go, right, you know, have some independence, kids, and think that that's going to work. That the whole sort of thing about becoming independent has to be explicitly taught to the pupils, almost as a sort of skill set that sits on top of whatever the content is, the subject is, that you're teaching them. And it's funny sometimes that that stuff doesn't feel like it always transfers neatly into being a teacher educator. That sort of instinct, which would absolutely be present in a teacher to behave in that way towards the pupils. And I must say, in a moment of self-reflection, I suppose, it did make me wonder whether the reason is because sometimes teacher education is seen as this really bureaucratic, form-filling kind of activity where we are around sort of telling people that they haven't filled their forms in right, and they almost feel like they haven't got permission to use all of the brilliant skills that they've got as classroom teachers in pursuit of teacher education instead.
Yeah, and I can literally hear, as you were saying that to me, I can remember co-observing with a mentor not too long ago and suggesting something that was very live. We were co-observing and the suggestion was something along the lines of coaching that student in the moment. We're going to talk about this in the next clip. And the mentor saying, can I do that? And, you know, and I had to reflect in that moment and think, gosh, you know, absolutely you can. But the fact that you don't think you can sort of reinforces that old school relationship that, you know, was there for a reason. It didn't happen, just by chance that, you know, this hierarchy that you sort of alluding to there, Tom, about, you know, the university's coming in.
Good biscuits in, yeah.
Yeah, and the mentor thinking, am I going to be picking up on the right things? You know, like we've got some kind of special sauce that, you know, means that we've got the recipe for observing and that we know what good teaching is. When actually it's really more of a dialogue.
Yes, we don't have the secret sauce when we don't work in that school and don't know those pupils and haven't watched that student teacher every day for 4 months, have we? But you're right, I can't remember if it was Furlong, it was somebody, or maybe it was Viv Ellis, who said this whole thing about genuine partnerships between university and schools is all well and good, but I think you mentioned it in another episode. It so easily tips into a role where we're these sort of rubber stamping bureaucrats, which is obviously the last thing we want because we're ex-classroom teachers ourselves. But you're right that there's all these brilliant instincts amongst our teacher educators, and sometimes it is just a process of giving permission to be as creative as they would be. Let's jump into that you were just talking about there, this idea that just because observation is sort of called observation and implies this idea that you're watching, there are many, many ways to do observation in the moment. And I think Scott talked about a continuum earlier on, didn't he? I think we were quite keen on this idea that there's almost a continuum that goes smoothly between just watching through to something that is actually getting pretty close to teaching. And so we spoke to them again. We asked Lauren and Scott for some challenges and some strategies that teacher educators in collaboration with the student teachers could perhaps put in place to make sure that that all important observation itself is as purposeful as it can possibly be.
So during the observation period, student teachers will also face some unique challenges. Scott, tell us about some of those.
Okay, so one challenge that student teachers might face is focusing on the learning behind the tasks that the students are presented with. Also, they might find it challenging to understand their role as a learner and as a professional whilst they are conducting observations. And additionally, I feel that students will find it challenging to access the teacher's invisible thinking and decision making, as not everything is explicit.
Mm. From your perspective, Lauren?
Well, linked to Scott's first point, focusing on the learning, do they really understand how the school's context is shaping the classroom practice? You know, what are they doing? Why have they chosen that approach? And then to understand how age and stage influence pedagogy, you know, the approaches are going to look different at each phase, for each age. Do they realise this? Do they know why?
Okay, so we've established those challenges. We've got some really purposeful, active strategies that mentors could use to help students overcome some of these challenges. So Lauren, you're going to tell us about the first one.
Yeah, so reverse pit stops. So in this case, the student teacher would be the one to call the pit stop first during an observation. They could ask a question, they could clarify something, you know, why did you do that? What are your next steps going to be? It's encouraging the in-action reflection, which is something I feel they struggle with, especially to start off with. And then the teacher then will call the second pit stop and they can explain again their thinking. So like Scott mentioned, making it explicit to the student. They could even pose a question to the student to reflect on as well. So it's just all really about encouraging that in-action reflection.
Thank you. So these are happening live in the moment, yeah, at appropriate times when they can sort of get that invisible made explicit. And we've got another one that sort of might support that invisible thinking coming to the fore. Scott, from your perspective?
Yeah, so a different strategy that mentors could try with their student teachers is to provide a live commentary during the lesson. So we don't stop and pause the lesson, we continue the lesson and have these brief moments with the student teacher as the learning is evolving in the class. Essentially, this is the student mentor modelling their thinking out loud whilst the student teacher is observing. And these can lead nicely into pit stops if they do need to take place. The biggest benefit of providing a live commentary is making decision-making explicit. So, for example, the teacher might say, "Oh, I've just changed my plan because I've noticed that group of children over there need more of a challenge, or they need support to enable them to meet the success criteria." Or it could be something like, "I've just asked open questions because I know that I'm trying to encourage deeper thinking with my more able learners in the class." So it then refocuses the attention of the student teacher to a specific aspect within the observation. So they're not looking at everything all of the time.
And lastly, it can be quite challenging for student teachers to know for sure that the lesson they have planned is going to work in practice. And we've got a last strategy that sort of uses observation to address some of those challenges.
So a strategy that I've used before is teach a lesson that's been planned by a student teacher. This provides them with an opportunity to see their planning in action. They get to identify the positives and the negatives in a supportive environment. And then the teacher can feedback live in the moment if any tweaks have had to be made to ensure that all of the learners are making the progress that they can within that session.
And I suppose it could be really beneficial to a student if the mentor teaches that lesson, it all goes swimmingly and, you know, can make them feel really confident.
Absolutely.
About their planning. Thank you both very much.
So loads in that discussion about making the invisible visible, really kind of addressing that point we were talking about earlier about student teachers not necessarily being able to spot things because so much is going on. So there's loads in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is why I really like this idea. And it was actually quite new to me, this idea of a pit stop conversation that can take place either in an observation that the mentor is doing of the student teacher. That would be the non-reverse option.
We've had the reverse one so far, haven't we? We'll get the normal one later.
We'll get the normal one later. But yeah, it was actually Rian Staples, who we'll hear from later on, who brought this approach to my attention. And then I actually found it in the literature and found out that it's an acronym. PIT is an acronym for precise, insightful and timely conversations during lessons. And I think there are some quite tight rules around how quick and timely sort of these pit stop conversations need to be. But if you want to read more about that, you could have a look at an article called Rethinking Student Teachers Professional Learning in Wales, Promoting Reflection in Action by Grigg et al. And that's in the...
in Swansea.
Yes, it is. It's in the curriculum journal, BERA's curriculum journal. It was a new one on me. And again, it's another sort of tangible, named, teacher education strategy that I think we've actually got sort of a lack of.
Yes.
That I can just envisage. I've actually never seen. I'd love to actually observe it. I'd love to have a go at it, actually. But I can really see the merit in doing that. Obviously, I think it has to be very carefully negotiated. You can't just, you know, spring it on the student teacher. But, you know, once they're well versed in it, I suppose you can see how on that continuum that Scott was mentioning earlier on, that pit stop conversation is like the natural thing that Tom and I would do when we're team teaching. Like, we might have a moment where I might say to Tom, like, how do you think this is landing? Where do we need to go next? And it's also almost the reflection in action conversation that a teacher is having with themselves as well. So it's almost modelling that and making it sort of automatic then for the student, embedding it for later on down the line.
Yeah, tricky for the teacher, the poor old teacher doing the lesson, of course, that they need to also find time to explain what's going on. But I think once you get experienced at being a mentor, or once you try it out a couple of times, and as you say, you've got to have some ground rules with a reverse one, haven't you, as well? Because you don't want the student teacher just kind of like crashing into your lesson, asking you why stuff's going on when you're at a vital moment and can't be disturbed. But there's usually moments in a lesson when the pupil's getting on with something and you can either ask a question or you can say, look, I think that has totally not landed with that group at the back. Watch what I do now, or I'm going to do this now, or what do you think I should do now? You know, there's so many ways you could do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we really like that one, and we're going to, it's going to reappear later on.
Yes. Sorry, Swansea, we're stealing it.
Yeah, we're having it. Okay, so now the observation has taken place and we've got a whole other set of challenges and proposed interventions that myself, Scott and Lauren are going to talk about when the observation has happened. Okay, so the observation has taken place. You're the mentor meeting with your student teacher afterwards, but again, we've got to acknowledge that they're going to find certain things quite challenging. So Scott, tell us about some of those challenges.
So first and foremost, reflection is going to be a challenge many students are going to be faced with, seeing beyond that surface level understanding and beginning to show an awareness of the complexities of what they've observed. That's definitely a hurdle that student teachers are going to have to overcome.
And a couple more challenges you've identified, Lauren.
Yeah, so applying what they've observed in their own practice, making it their own, and then are they able to plan their next steps? So move beyond that reflection then into action.
Okay, so again, with those challenges in mind, starting with this issue of reflection and reflecting on what just happened, what strategies can we suggest to mentors to really guide them in that and ensure, as you mentioned earlier on, that that reflection is quite deep and that they're going to really learn from it?
Well, as we know, reflection is not an easy process and it is challenging to think about what you are thinking about. So there are reflective models to help scaffold the thinking available on the PLP for mentors and senior mentors to use. These are by Driscoll, by Bain, by Gibbs and by Kolb. So these structures support student teachers in moving away from the surface level of understanding and developing that deeper level, linking the theory, the practice with their personal experiences. It also deepens the student teacher's understanding of how to critically analyse their own teaching and again how to identify what is effective and what is not. But you know, if these models are not working for your student, or if they would prefer to use a different resource, there are multiple different things on the clinical practice guide that mentors can use to support their conversations around reflection. So these are the mentoring conversation guide and the clinical reasoning practice prompts. So these are to help the student teachers develop a clearer understanding of what they have observed. And then these reflections can either be written or they can be in verbal or in audio form.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. And still, Lauren, we can have student teachers that might need an extra intervention before they can engage in that reflective dialogue with their mentor. So what would you suggest for those sorts of student teachers?
So for those who are still finding it quite challenging, the mentors could model self-reflection. So it could be a lesson that has been recorded that they watch, or it could be a lesson that the student has just observed and the mentor would just self-reflect in front of the student teacher to exemplify how it should or could be done, mm-hmm. Which then also could be recorded.
Yes, of course. And they can sort of come back to that as a model of good practice, yes, to support them in taking that forward in their own. Then we've got this issue of being able to sort of apply or to sort of translate what they've learned from the observation and all that good reflection into action, into practice. What would you recommend mentors do to sort of smoothen out that transition process?
So one thing they could do is to team plan next steps. Encourage the student to explain out loud what it is they're planning and why. This then enables the mentor to see exactly what the student has been able to take away and implement and make judgments about what further support might be required, for example. They could also encourage then and direct the student teacher to start making those connections between what they've read, what they've seen, and their own practice. Encourage them to try strategies that they've seen, but to make sure they adapt them to suit their own personality and their own context, because I find often student teachers try to emulate and copy their mentor or other classroom teachers, but 9 times out of 10, that's not going to work for them. They have to find their own way. They have to become their own teacher. So it's about the mentor encouraging them to try the things they've seen, but to adapt it so it suits them and their character and their context, especially when moving from CP1 to CP2. And further beyond again then.
And I just want to add as well that student teachers need to remember that reflection is an essential part of the process, and, you know, in changing strategies and changing ways of working and ways of thinking is good.
Yes.
You know, and we all do it day in, day out as practitioners. So the more practice that they get earlier on, the better they will get at being reflective practitioners moving through their career.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose just asking the question, what might this look like if it's successful in your practice, could get those cogs turning and help them to put that into action. Thank you very much.
So really important to take that observation and do something with it, unpack it, pack it back up, whatever it may be. I suppose some people might be thinking, oh gosh, you know, here's Cardiff Met asking us to do even more stuff when we're the mentor. But I suppose it's not so much new stuff, it's just more detailed ways of doing things with the stuff that's going to be happening already, you know, mentor meetings, observation periods, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm all about this. It's, you know, when we think about the things that mentors are unlikely to skip as part of the process, you know, observations is probably one of those things. So how can we just fine tune that, soup that up, configure it in such a way that the student teachers and the mentor, so it's something that comes through in all of those conversations with Scott and Lauren, is this kind of reciprocal relationship between student teacher and mentor, that they each rely on each other. And actually, your student teacher as an observer in the room could actually be really useful to help you garner information about how the pupils are responding to pedagogical approaches to particular activities that you just don't have the capacity to be able to do. So, it doesn't have to be onerous, doesn't have to be time consuming. If I were to put money on it, I would probably say that the two stages that perhaps need more thought, that have perhaps not had that thought and care and attention in previous years, is the before and the during. I think a lot of mentors are probably really keen to know what the student teacher found from the observation. But if, you know, if you reflect back and if you think, did they really pick out the things I would have wanted them to? Well, then we've got to do some input. We've got to do that pre-briefing at the beginning to just make sure that they're focusing on the right things.
Yeah, and just going back to that earlier point as well about the idea of these things acting on a continuum, it's interesting, we were starting to talk about team planning and team teaching towards the end of that discussion. And part of this, as for me, has been reflecting on the fact that we've tended to sort of isolate three activities for our student teachers. I don't know, listeners, if you're not a Cardiff Met people, whether this applies to you as well, but we have, well, we don't call it observing, we subsume it under research and inquiry, but effectively when they've got whole days of nothing but research and inquiry right at the start, they are basically observing. Team planning and teaching, and then independent teaching. And going back to this idea of needing to give permission and a sense that perhaps we have rules and that kind of thing as crazy bureaucrat types, it can be easy to think of those as three completely different activities. And we've already talked about the idea that observation might flow quite seamlessly into something that looks a lot more like team teaching. And I think perhaps it could flow from team teaching to independent teaching. This is, you know, slightly off the point, really. We had a very interesting discussion in the preparation day for this with school colleagues about, oh, you know, what they were comparing notes on when do they intervene if a lesson's not going very well for a student teacher. And it was all very much in the sense of, oh, gosh, you know, am I very interventionist? Do I jump in the minute things are not going right? Or do I let it all sort of catch fire a little bit? And all of that. But it was all in the sense that, oh, it's, you know, you're hitting the big red button, a big fail button, you know, if you have to jump in and take over the classroom, the student teacher. And I was thinking, well, if we could just think about team teaching and independent teaching and all of these things, observing as more of a continuum, you could frame it more as, well, we move back down the continuum a bit more towards something a bit more team teaching, because that wasn't going fantastically well, rather than the much more sort of almost punitive feeling, oh, I had to step in and take over the lesson.
Yes, I think that's a very good point about how these teacher education approaches actually work in tandem with each other. They're not separate entities. And I guess in that same vein, observations that student teachers make of mentors in the early stages of their placement then move towards flipping that arrangement, and the mentor is observing the student teacher, maybe having done quite a bit of team teaching in between, in the interim. And now they're in an independent teaching mode and their mentor is coming in to observe them. And I guess if you've established this sort of repertoire of this preparation before the observation, you know, what is the focus? Well, actually, that's really good practice for the mentor observing the student teacher. If you've got an agreed or a shared focus, then there's no sort of fear of being caught out necessarily. And it's not to say that you can't go a bit rogue. You know, if something goes wrong, if you've, you know, if it's not within the agreed focus, then you're of course going to need to talk about it. But I think there's a lot of fear around observation because you're not inside the head of the observer. You don't know what they're looking for. It might be some sort of standard that they haven't really articulated to you. You know, so there can be a lot of fear around observation. So before the observation, agreeing a focus, you know, and establishing how you're going to operate in the room when you're observing, asking yourself as the mentor, what is it best for me to do as an observer? Where should I be? You know, is it better that I am on the periphery with my clipboard, or do I need to get in amongst the learners? Do I need to apply a pit stop or two? You know, how am I going to observe what I need to give the most to the student teacher or to support the student teacher afterwards in getting what they need from this observation? And of course, afterwards, you've got a whole unpacking process, a process of feedback, for which there are multiple strategies that you could take that we've talked about in previous episodes that we're not going to go over again. But, you know, suffice to say that we've got a whole other suite of audio clips and video clips about preparing for observing student teachers in their practice. But what we've got at the end of that playlist is a really nice conversation between a senior mentor and a university tutor, Rian Wynne-Griffiths and Rian Staples. And they're going to talk together about how to make the most of student-teacher observation in practice.
Rian, what approaches do you take to student-teacher feedback, and what influence is this?
I think when they first come to you on their first placement, and they start observing lessons within the department, all over the school, is to get them to start straight away by looking at the pedagogy, by looking at the techniques employed by that teacher they're watching. And then when they give you the feedback about the lesson, not to concentrate on the personality of the teacher, because personality has nothing to do with it. Good teaching comes from knowing your class and choosing the right techniques for that class on that day. And therefore giving them the language of evaluation and giving them the ability to start looking with you and with each other. Because obviously when I see them in the senior mentor meeting once a week, we'll all discuss the lessons that we've seen. And so together we're looking at what worked, why did it work? So what did that teacher do? And how do you know that that worked with that class? What could you see in their work? What could you hear in their discussions? And what did the teacher use? Did the teacher use, you know, the whiteboards? Did she use an exit ticket? How did that teacher know that that teaching technique had an effect on her class? So you're almost taking personality out of it. And there's something about listening to the way that they will give feedback, because that will give you as a mentor an insight into how they would like feedback to be given to them. Because you have to be careful in that first term they're with you, that the feedback is given in a positive way, but also it allows for them developing as young teachers.
Okay, Rhian, what are you hoping to achieve with all these different approaches that you're employing?
I'm hoping that the mentors will give feedback from the point of view of the techniques chosen and the effect on the pupils. I'm hoping that each feedback session is a conversation, that the students are aware of why they chose those techniques during those lessons with that group of students, that there will always be a chance to improve during that feedback session. And in that chat that they're looking at, what was the intention? So to go back to their lesson plan and think step by step, right, what did you want to happen when you chose that technique? Did it work? Was there progress? Did the students make progress? If so, how do you know? How can you prove that those pupils made progress during that lesson? And then I think the most important questions at the end of any feedback is, so what are you going to read next? What piece of research are you going to look at next? What would you like to observe? Do you want to do a bit of teaching to the top? Do you want to look at classroom management? Do you want to look at improving literacy? And also to have the opportunity for them maybe to team teach or to pit stop teach within that process. And then thirdly, to ask them at the end of each session, what would you trial next? And in that trial, and using that trial, what are you going to trial next? It gives them the opportunity to know that they can try something, and if it fails, it doesn't matter because it's a trial. And if it fails, then you read something else, or you observe something else, or you team teach something else.
Lovely, Rhian. And to finish, does your approach change depending on the student teacher that you're actually mentoring at the time?
Yes, it does. It depends on the student teacher and it depends on whether it's the first or the second placement. And also on various things. If you think about their upbringing, their education, how they received feedback when they were being taught by teachers, because it can be a very scary lot. And we have to remember that we're dealing with adults, because we're so used to dealing with young children and teenagers. So the language needs to be different. And I think that's where I was stressing it needs to be a conversation, not that they're just listening to you give feedback. Sometimes not to be afraid, if a student is brilliant and the lesson is fantastic, then tell them so. But also get them to evaluate why that lesson was so good. And it felt good. Did it also have that effect on the pupils? Did they make progress, and how do you know? With students who are maybe a little less confident, we've tried things. Sometimes we've asked a senior teacher or a very confident teacher within the department to teach, employing some of the techniques that maybe that new teacher is struggling with. And then I will then evaluate the lesson with that student teacher. And it kind of gives that distance between the personality that you're watching and the technique. So what we look at is the techniques employed and the effect of those techniques on those pupils in front of us. And they gradually then become more confident because they know you're viewing their lesson in the same way, not judging them, but judging their approaches and their developing pedagogy.
You alluded to pit stopping earlier. Can you elaborate a bit more about that?
It's not one of my ideas. It's an idea that was introduced for NQTs, I think, by a university in Wales. And if a student teacher is going to try a new technique, and instead of it being a cold observation, they're allowed 3 pit stops. So if they're struggling a little bit with this new thing they're doing, they can go to their mentor and ask for some guidance. In the same way, if the mentor can think of a way to improve the lesson, or maybe get that little table over there who's lost the will to be a bit more involved in the lesson, then they can give them some guidance. And a lot of students like it because it feels like a safer place to be, even though they are still in charge of the lesson and the pupils are completely unaware that the pit stop is happening.
Lovely. Diolch, Rhian.
So, Rhian Staples and Rhian Wynne Griffiths there. Rhian Staples from Rhyd y Wain in Aberdare, and our very own Rhian Wynne from here in Cardiff Met. And I think one of the things that jumped out at me from that, I don't know about you, Emma, is this: there is this sort of problem with observed lessons, and by which I mean now the mentor is observing the student teacher teach, that they really can turn into a weird sort of performance that doesn't really do a whole lot of good. There's almost this sense that it's much higher stakes and it's got to be perfect and you've got to put on a bit of a show. And I know we've tried to counteract that a bit, but in terms of the fact that our observed lessons of student teachers don't actually count towards their assessments, we have something much more holistic. But it's nice to hear those things there because it just takes it away from that weird unnatural place.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it goes all the way back to that first point that Lauren made at the start of the episode about refocusing the student teacher's attention on the pupils. And if they can just relax and focus on what the pupils' reactions and their assessments of the learners, you know, and pupil voice and all of that is telling them about what's working, what's not working. And, you know, of course, this is when they're getting really proficient, actually, as teachers to be able to do this. But as soon as they can start to do that, they will hopefully move away from this performativity, this focus on self, this I must include this strategy because my mentor's going to want to see X, Y, Z. You know, it's just a massive distraction, really, from the most important people in the room.
Yeah, definitely. So loads of really good things there. It was nice to see, or to hear rather, that Rhian was actually talking about some of the stuff that came from the other two when they were discussing it the other way around, which just kind of goes to show how reciprocal that relationship is when it's really firing between a student teacher and a mentor. I mean, yeah, the mentor might be more prescriptive at the beginning, but by the end, it should be a bit more of a two-way street. So lovely goodies there for everybody. And thanks to all the colleagues who participated in producing that work. I know you're continuing to produce more goodies in your mentor lead role, so we'll probably be hearing more from that. But now we are going to move on to the short slots. Something to try. You can have the whole episode for that, folks, because there's plenty of things to try in there. You can take your pick. But Emma's got something interesting.
Yes, I mentioned this earlier in the episode, but I'll give you the full details now. It's a book that you can get digitally. You can buy it in print for a reasonable sum on various different book-selling websites. It is entitled The School Mentor Handbook, Essential Skills and Strategies for Working with Student Teachers, and it's by Hazel Hagger, Catherine Byrne and Donald McIntyre. The sort of holy trinity.
Wow. Yes. They are.
It's published by Routledge. It was actually originally published in 1993, although I would say that this is pretty seminal, actually. It's got some really good stuff that has really stood the test of time. It's got a whole unit. It's sort of, the chapters are split into units, like a sort of mentor curriculum in a way. And unit 2 is entitled Observation, Why Do It? Guidelines for the Different Kinds of Observation and a Summary. And it's really accessible. It's quite quick to read, but it's obviously been written in consultation with and probably based on research with mentors in the field working with student teachers. So that would be my recommendation.
Yes, definitely. And those books can be had for ridiculously cheap prices on well-known online places, can't they?
They can.
Yeah, okay. There we go. So we've had a bit of a run around the student-mentor relationship as it applies to observations in both directions, although mainly student teachers observing when they're new to somewhere. And we hope you found that useful, whether you're working in a Welsh Initial Teacher Education Partnership or somewhere much further afield. Thank you for listening.
We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Thanks to everyone involved in creating our Mentor Handbook goodies: Lauren Rees, Scott Morgan, Rhian Staples, Rhian Wynne Griffiths, and two who you didn't hear in this episode, Nia Lockett and Lucy Donovan. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford, and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambin, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.